supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
Welcome to my house.
That was not Dan Gottlieb. This, in fact, is Dan Gottlieb. So, welcome to my house also. Happy Halloween, everyone. Well, to most of us, the holiday's about things that are orange and black. Apple bobbing and pumpkin carving, candy, and so on and so forth. It's a time of year when we are allowed, even encouraged, to follow our dark impulses, exploring the paranormal, devilish things in film at haunted houses, and by way of dressing up. All of it can be a bit scary, scary good for some, and scary bad for others. Today we're going to break that down and talk about what the appeal is of scary things in popular culture and how long that appeal goes back in our ancestry. Before we do anything else, our intern, Emily Haas, helps us get in the mood for today's show.
Why do we like to be scared? I went to Eastern State Penitentiary to find out. The penitentiary runs a haunted prison tour that attracts a diverse crowd of thrill-seekers from far and wide. When I asked people why they had come, I heard one answer again and again.
Adrenaline.
I enjoy, like, the adrenaline rush.
It makes your adrenaline run and
to get that adrenaline rush.
Your adrenaline rush is pumping. I want to feel alive.
But what I wanted to learn was what might be underneath this desire to be scared. Here's what I found.
Well, I like it because ever since I was a kid, my family's, like, always watched horror movies. We're big on Halloween. We have Halloween parties every year, so I just like coming to them and
it's funny at first, you know. Well, a little scary, but then you think about it. You say, oh, my God, I got scared over that.
You like haunted houses?
Yes!
Why do you like to be scared? Why do you
because
think you like
it's
to be
funny.
Why is it funny to be scared?
Well, because we're doing a bet. Whoever gets scared the most loses.
Oh, it's a contest.
Yeah.
How long have you liked scary stuff?
All my life.
What was the first thing that you liked feeling scared by?
My aunt scaring me when she was babysitting me. She was mean, but take her teeth out, make scary faces.
Well, the first thing that scared me is my brother used to lock me in this basement. We lived in a big apartment building, so there was a lot of rooms down there. So I used to try to get out through the back, so I had to go like half a block through the building. It was scary.
So maybe you like to come to haunted houses because that gives you power over the kind of situations that you didn't have power over as kids. Is that too out there?
It's possible. I came here because something really might happen here. I mean, they really say it's haunted. Something could really happen.
That was our intern, Emily Haas, interviewing people upon their exit from something very scary. And full disclosure here, Emily was terrified of even going out there to do the interview. Well, that was a great way to set up today's conversation about the lure of scary things, what draws us to them, and how they've affected us since the beginning of time. So weighing in on this, we have two guests, Glenn Sparks and David Gilmore. Glenn is a professor of communication at Purdue University. He studied the effects of horror films on viewers' physiology. He joins us by phone from Indiana. Glenn, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And we also have on the phone David Gilmore. He's a professor of anthropology at Stony Brook in New York. He's written Monsters, Evil Beings, Mythical Beasts, and All Manner of Imaginary Terrors. He joins us by phone from New York. David, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
And if you want to join our conversation, Our number is 888-477-149499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. David, let's start with you. Halloween's tonight. So I've got to ask about our history, not only history of Halloween, but other similar holidays like Mardi Gras, Chinese New Year, Carnival in Rio. They all have similar feels. We all don masks and pretend to be somebody we're not.
Yes, that's very true, and it's historically very, very ancient indeed. You'd be surprised how far masking and terrifying imagery goes back. In fact, some of our earliest images on cave walls, probably dating to 30, 35,000 years ago, the very dawn of human imagination and consciousness, reflect creatures that are half human, half animal, staring eyes, paws, claws, and so on. So this goes way back in our history.
I frankly, David, I don't get that. So if I'm living in a cave and 30,000 years ago and, you know, things actually do go bump in the night when you're living in a cave, I don't think I need a Stephen King book, but apparently I do.
Well, put yourself in that position. Every step outside that cave is an adventure in fear. There are large predators waiting to attack you and eat you up. Maybe this is a way of portraying these images, portraying the things that frighten us. Maybe this is a way of learning some kind of control over that image.
So it's kind of what behavioral psychologist might call desensitization.
It could be. It could be practice. It could be therapeutic. An attempt to get control over that which scares you, to make it something different outside yourself, a real object that then you can control.
Glenn, I'd like you to weigh in on this. I'd like to hear your thoughts on the function of creating fear in a world that's already scary.
Well, I think that control theme is a very important one. In my research with frightening media, that comes out quite a bit, particularly for males. There seems to be a desire to be able to say, after you've been exposed to something that's really frightening or terrifying, that you made it through, that you conquered it. And in fact, there's been some interesting experimental work with males and females watching frightening media together. And when males display all of the nonverbal conquering signs, females tend to find them more attractive than if they display signs of fear. And it works the other way around with females. Males find females attractive when they are displaying the signs of fear rather than signs of conquering. So I do think there's a gender thing going on here, but particularly for males, this desire to conquer the threat, to be able to say that you made it, I think is a very important gratification that some people are getting out of exposing themselves voluntarily to this kind of stuff.
And I think the added factor of women being attracted to men who show no fear and men being attracted to women who appear vulnerable, of course, that goes on today to a certain extent in most relationships, but I'm sure that was also happening in those caves 30,000 years ago.
Well, we can only speculate, but if you go back to the earliest literature, you know, we have the hero myth. Joseph Campbell, the mythologist, wrote a long and fascinating book about it, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, in which, yes, men are selected to be heroes. They go out, they conquer the dragon, the beast. They save their society, they rescue the maiden. This is an ancient theme in literature and art, sculpture, everything. It goes way back, probably part of the hero role for men, absolutely.
You, David, your book opens up with the following sentence. The mind needs monsters. Well, when I was a child, I was terrorized by a boogeyman under my bed. Now, you're not going to tell me I needed that boogeyman, because I really didn't need that boogeyman. I was fine without him.
Well, whether you needed it or not, you would have to, you had to invent it. You know, whether there's a God or not, man invents him. And
yeah.
We create these. What we do is we distance our fears from within ourselves, that dark place that you mentioned, the unconscious or whatever you want to call it, and we enliven them. We create a living, breathing thing, a monster, if you will, a boogeyman, an ogre, whatever, and we stick it under our bed. And then we look under there, we search around, we look in the closet, and it's not there. So we've gotten rid of it. This is a way of distancing, objectifying, and learning to gain some power over our own fears. It's part of the growing up process.
David, this is also a time that that children first begin to understand death to a certain extent. That, you know, this is a time often when grandparents die or pets die, and it's their introduction to the permanence of death. And you know, considering that their parents might die, I mean, this is terrifying to a kid. So it makes sense that they would need to do something with that fear.
Well, yes, children have to learn some way to manage their inner terrors. And death, of course, is one of them that you learn about when you grow up. We're the only animal that knows we must die. And after we die, we come back at Halloween as ghosts, and we become evil creatures. And that's a curious thing. Why does that trip to that dark place turn us around and make our mothers and fathers, our aunts and uncles, nice people, but they come back as terrifying images? So that's a curious psychological transformation that I've always been fascinated by, too.
Well, let me suggest something to you, if I may. That I've done some research into scapegoating. And it turns out the earliest I could find of the concept of scapegoating comes from the Old Testament, where it says, "You shall imbue the head of the goat with all the sins of the people and banish the goat forever." But here comes the goat, keeps returning, the devil has cloven hooves, so it keeps coming back. We can't get rid of our sins.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's the function of rituals of expiation, that we displace. The psychological term is displacement or projection, yeah, of that which frightens us most, which is, you know, internal more than external, and we make a creature out of it, into which we imbue all of our fears, and then we distance itself. We control it, we defeat it, if you will. We go out and battle it. Of course, it comes back because we can never get rid of our own unconscious completely.
Yeah, Glenn, I wonder if this is akin to a lot of work that's been done on the brain and spirituality. And, you know, like David alluded to, similar to when the brain calls for a higher power. Of course, the argument is whether a higher power created the brain that calls for a higher power. But I wonder if this is parallel here.
Yeah, I think that's an area that a number of people are certainly exploring at the moment. I don't know that we can really say definitively about that, but I have studied in the context of frightening media. I've also studied belief in the paranormal and that sort of thing. And in that literature, you certainly get into the motivation for these kinds of beliefs. And I think there is some link between, you know, belief in these supernatural themes and things that scare us, and also the spiritual domain in particular. I really liked what you said earlier, Dan, about you didn't need to be terrorized as a child, because I think that, you know, when we talk about the reasons why people enjoy this kind of material, we sometimes can make a mistake in emphasizing all the motivations that are contributing to enjoyment, and we forget that not everybody does enjoy exposing themselves to this kind of material, and particularly for children, a lot of the media that's around out there can absolutely be terrifying, and I don't think there's any good reason necessarily for parents to try to deliberately expose their children to images that are really going to upset them. Young children don't have a very sophisticated set of emotional coping skills that have been developed. And I think that sometimes we make a mistake into thinking that children need to, you know, learn how to handle these sorts of things at a very early age when they're not well equipped to do so.
Yeah, and they're also not very well equipped to distinguish real from fantasy.
That's right. That distinction doesn't happen until somewhere around 6, 7, 8 years old, and I think parents sometimes get confused when they're trying to set rules for media. They use a rule that says, well, the older my child is, the more liberal I can be in terms of exposing my children to different things. And that turns out not to be a very good rule. Children who are just beginning to understand that distinction between reality and fantasy now may not be frightened at the ugly characters that a young child is scared of, because they can label those characters as fantasy, but they now may be scared of things that they know possibly can happen in the real world, and they're still young enough that they don't really know quite how to cope with those things. So you get things like violence and natural disasters and technological disasters. Those things start showing up in reports that children at that age give us, and the parents of children at that age give us, as things that really can create some emotional turmoil in the home.
Yeah, and for God's sakes, do not let children watch news on TV.
That's right. That's right. I second that motion.
Yeah, that is not healthy. David.
Yes.
Do you see a relationship between the external world and the level of fear we create? For example, you know, I think back to around World War II, and you know, this is Doris Day and Fred Astaire, and it was all happy movies. And then the Cold War, it seems, gave birth to Alfred Hitchcock.
Well, I have to disagree with that. I mean, the 30s and 40s gave rise to the films Dracula and Frankenstein, and there were so many wonderful black and white horror movies made, Cat People and so on. So, and if you go back in literature, you know, the Dracula, Frankenstein stories go 19th century, and you go back further, and you find first evidence of writing we have in English has been preserved as Beowulf. And in Beowulf, we've got a monster named Grendel, and you've got a dragon, and you've got the hero fighting them. It goes way back. It's eternal. It's true in all cultures, and all cultures have boogeymen by which they keep their children in line. So that's part of the growing up process.
So I would imagine then you would disagree with Robin Wood. New York Times article quoted him as saying that scary movies provide a valuable window into what our society represses or oppresses.
Oh, no, I would agree with that. The question is the content, the shape, the form. Not the function. The function is always to bring us into an understanding of our own fears and gaining control of our own fears. But what shapes the phantoms take have to do a lot with what's currently going on scientifically and politically. I mean, you look at the movies and films made in the 50s and 60s, and you had all of these creatures that were unleashed by atomic energy. That was the critical issue then. Now it's terrorism. I mean, of course it's relevant.
Hmm. Glenn, I want to just follow up on my Hitchcock question with you before we go to break. One of Hitchcock's comments was that we like to be scared when we feel safe in that context. Is that accurate physiologically?
I tend to agree with Hitchcock on that. I actually don't believe that people enjoy the pure emotion of fear, but we are capable of feeling more than one thing at the same time. And so I think that the thing that happens here in different individuals is how that fear gets processed. And we can talk about some of the ways that happens.
Yeah.
But I think, yes, basically Hitchcock is right. If we feel like we're safe, we can tolerate some measure of fear, meaning our well-being is threatened. And it just depends on what that situation is and the things that we believe we can bring to bear to help us to cope with that. There's some pretty interesting dynamics that are, I think, are at work in say, frightening movies that help to contribute to that enjoyment.
All right. Well, you've just mentioned one of the things we're going to have to talk about after our break. My guests are Glenn Sparks and David Gilmore, and we're talking about scary things. We are in the process of trying to understand why we like to be scared. Glenn Sparks is a professor of communication at Purdue. David Gilmore is a professor of anthropology at Stony Brook. Well, you're listening to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We will be back in just 60 seconds.
ChristianaCare Health System's Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, ChristianaCare cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year, and the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. ChristianaCare, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at christianacare.org/heartleaders.
Picky eaters, hectic schedules, rising grocery prices, many families struggle to make meals that fit their budgets, tastes, and lives, and are healthy to boot. I'm Mike and Scott. Join us for the next WHYY Parenting Seminar when we'll discuss healthy nutrition for kids and families. We'll also talk about cooking with children, Tuesday, November 8th at 6:30 here at WHYY. To register, visit whyy.org/member experience.
Even a good old cup of tea won't settle.
Nobody's gonna come through that door.
Don't drink the tea. Oh, for God's sakes, don't drink the tea. Oh, I wish I could have helped her back then. Oh, the guilt. Anyway, that was Jaws leading us into the Chainsaw Massacre. Not pretty. Both of those movies scared me something terrible. So that's what we're talking about today on Voices. What scares us and why some people enjoy being scared. We're talking about with Glenn Sparks. He's an expert on horror films and physiology. David Gilmore has written a book about monsters, evil beings, mythical beasts, and all manners of imaginary terrors. Our phone number, if you have the courage to call in, is 888-477-9499. So, Glenn, I want to talk to you about some of your findings about why some people derive pleasure when watching scary media. When we heard Emily Haas at the top of the show and her interviews, the theme was adrenaline, 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 and they liked the adrenaline buzz.
Yes, and I think some people do like the adrenaline. That's one of the reasons why people may enjoy these experiences. And again, it's not that they necessarily enjoy the emotional experience of fear. That is, of having their well-being threatened, but that comes with a physiological arousal. There's actually some interesting new research on individual differences along this line, such that some people's brains may have autoreceptors that actually dampen the effects of dopamine that come when a person is aroused, and the arousal, in a sense, the way I understand that research, really can't get through, and so some people don't experience the enjoyment associated with that adrenaline rush, and other people do. So there may be some hardwired individual differences here, but I think there's also another very interesting dynamic that's working in a lot of these experiences, and That is the transfer of arousal. So that we know that when a person becomes afraid, their body typically becomes physiologically aroused. I mean, we can, in a scary movie, heart rate increases and systolic blood pressure and so forth. And then what happens shortly after the film is over, in a lot of cases, I noted in Emily's interview that a lot of the children, they were all together. they were shouting together, and this was a group experience for them. And that's often the case with a scary movie. What happens after that film is over is that the emotional reaction changes to one that's pleasant. If you're with your friends and you're having a great social time, what happens is there's arousal still in the system from the fear that essentially transfers, and the role of arousal is to intensify every emotion. And so we tend to oftentimes come out of these experiences if the following emotion is pleasant, and people really experience a kind of a euphoria. Well, then we remember that, and we think back, well, I remember feeling euphoric when I saw that movie, and so let's go see another one like that. It's not necessarily that people enjoyed being scared, but they enjoyed what came after that. I sometimes compare it to riding a roller coaster. You know, I don't think anybody really up on the top deck of a coaster looking down and contemplating that the car is going to fall really enjoys that emotional experience. But when the coaster ride is over and then you can say, I made it through, I conquered it, and some people do have this basic ability to enjoy adrenaline rushes, all of those things are enjoyed.
Well, I don't know, Glenn. When I watch people at the top of a roller coaster, notice, watch is the word. They look like they're having a good time. And when I watch, as they're coming down, they look like they're having a good time. And the question I always have when I'm watching the joy is, what the hell's wrong with those people? You know?
Yeah, I think, I mean, some people, you know, the roller coaster addicts, I mean, they've really learned to process that experience without probably experiencing much fear at all. They've become desensitized to the ride, we might say, so that their fear that they might feel the first time they take it, you know, they've learned that, well, the coaster is not going to crash, you know, and I'm going to be okay. And so those elements that contribute to fear are not likely to be there for them. So that may be what's happening with those folks. For a person like me, who was terrified when I took a roller coaster ride when I was 7 and never rode them again until I was 40, you know, that next ride was a pretty scary experience.
Glenn, why the hell did you get on a roller coaster when you were 40? You're one of those people that I want to know what's wrong with you.
I avoided them for years, and it was the fact that my son, who when he was a teenager, simply he put too much pressure on me.
He shook.
And it was part of my natural inclination to show that my son that you know, I could do it too.
David, back to the caves, huh?
here's the hero motif coming back,
right,
on us, as it were. But after seeing Jaws, you know, I stayed out of the ocean for about 2 or 3 years. On the other hand, it's something you think about, that, you know, that tingle, adrenaline. Yes, adrenaline is fight or flight syndrome. It's stimulating and it's exciting and something you like to stimulate yourself with. It's almost like a food arousal or sexual arousal, something you go through. And people sitting around the campfire in pre-literate society, telling scary stories, they go through it together. So it creates a spirit of the group. It's like a hazing. It's something you get through and get through the other side, and you feel satisfied having been stimulated, scared, and you've conquered your fears.
I've got to tell you that, you know, people like, especially men, like those fears and like to conquer those fears, and they might like roller coasters and gory movies, but when I see one of those guys in my office, he doesn't like talking about scary stuff at all. You know, he likes avoiding scary stuff, like his own vulnerability or his fears or his nightmares.
Absolutely. This goes back to the earlier theme that not everybody does enjoy this experience. And in the area, in my research with Frightening Media, when we do surveys and we ask people how they react to this kind of entertainment, it's really an interesting breakdown. It roughly is about one-third of any sample that I take says that they systematically will avoid this kind of entertainment. They really can't find themselves in this entertainment able to experience that gratification that so many other people might be able to experience. Another third of the people say that they will systematically seek out this kind of entertainment. And then another group, they're more equivocal. They've had some experiences that they enjoyed here, but they've also had some experiences that were pretty upsetting. And one of the things that I think contributes to the avoidance of this kind of entertainment is the fact that these negative emotional experiences, when they occur, they can linger on for a long time. These memories are stored in the part of our brain that preserves these experiences and brings them up again. And so it's not uncommon to find people who have long-term lingering responses to a film that they've seen, even one particular scene, such that they just can't see themselves going back and watching this kind of entertainment again.
Yeah. Well, I just got notified by our producer, Jennifer Lynn, that she's got a little something she wants to play. I don't know what it is, but let's hear. Al, let it roll.
How old are you?
12.
Is there someone inside you?
Sometimes.
Who is it?
I don't know.
Is it Captain Howdy?
I don't know.
If I ask him to tell me, will you let him answer?
No.
Why not?
I'm afraid.
If he talks to me, I think he'll leave you. Do you want him to leave you?
Yes.
I'm speaking to the person inside of Braga now. If you are there, you too are hypnotized and must answer all my questions. Come forward and answer me now. Are you the person inside of Reagan? Who are you?
End the cut! End the cut! End it! Stop it! I'm not one of these happy, scary guys. Anyway, the idea of a therapist being attacked like that, it's not a pleasant experience for me. That was The Exorcist. And I do want to say anything, full disclosure. We are taught in graduate school not to talk to monsters. It's just bad psychotherapy. So I do want to go back to our callers, and I want to talk more about children. Speaking of Jennifer Lynn, she says she's amazed that her 11-year-old speaks very knowledgeably about ghosts, David. And you don't think that's strange at all, that kids really think about these things?
Well, death is frightening, and certainly it's a dialogue with the unknown. You talked about cut the scene, but we can't really, because it's unfolding. It's on the screen inside. And the questions that children ask are attempts to confront those fears. Death is one of them, and what's on the other side becomes a big question. And really, Halloween It's almost entirely about that. You know, it's in the it's the Day of the Dead. It has a long standing in the Catholic tradition. It's when you go to the graveyard and pay respects to the dead, but it's also a frightening time because dead answer. So it's really a dialogue, the scary thing. The monster is both within and without. We create it, and it talks to us. And that's what the folktale is all about. It's a communication.
I have good news for many of our younger listeners. I don't know your ages, Glenn and David, but my demons, like me, are 65 years old now, and they're just too tired to scare me anymore. You know, my demons are on Medicare. So you know, that's the good news. That's something to look forward to. Let's go to the phones. We've got Will on the line. Hi, Will.
Dr. Gottlieb, sorry. My question really is, how do we ease our children into scary movies, knowing that no matter what we do, someday they're going to be a sleepover and they're going to see a very scary, very gory movie? And is there a way to ease our children into this, to slowly incorporate?
Well, I'm going to turn this over to Glenn, but before I do, how old is he?
My 9 years old.
9 years old. All right, Glenn.
Yeah, I think that parents generally in the current environment that we're in don't need to really worry about easing your child into this. It's there's so much media around us that, like you say, it's going to happen at a sleepover. I think one of the key things is just being very sensitive to your own child and have conversations with your child about what they see on the media, and you can talk about, there's opportunities to talk about whether something that was seen upset you in some way and why did it upset you, and you can try to help children by reassuring them if something has scared them, but I think it's generally not very healthy for parents to try to systematically introduce things deliberately that might terrify or scare your children. I think it's best to try to control the media diet so that your child is not going to see that sort of thing, at least under your supervision.
And Will, speaking of supervision, I mean, the rule of thumb with any of this stuff is to do it with your child, have a dialogue with your child while it's going on about how they fear, what they think, how they interpret this. And
absolutely.
You know, and that's always helpful.
Yep.
Thanks for your call, Will, and I do hope it was helpful. We're going to take a short break. We're going to go back to our callers, and I want to talk to my guests about how they got interested in what they got interested in. My guests are Glenn Sparks and David Gilmore. Glenn's at Purdue University. He studied the effects of horror films on people's physiology. David Gilmore is a professor of anthropology at Stony Brook. His book is Monsters, Evil Beings, Mythical Beasts, and All Manners of Imaginary Terrors. Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
As a nurse with a bachelor's degree, you are essential to leading improvements in healthcare. A master's degree from the College of Nursing at Villanova is designed to advance your career as a nurse practitioner, nurse anesthetist, nurse educator, or administrator. The college, which also offers the DNP and PhD in nursing, understands your commitment to balancing career, family, and education. The College of Nursing at Villanova University supports WHYY. Villanova.edu/nursing.
Santa Muerte is no saint, at least not in the eyes of the Catholic Church. She's a popular fixture that literally means the saint of death. But that doesn't stop drug dealers, the rich, and poor housewives from seeking her good graces. We'll find out why Santa Muerte has become the go-to saint of Mexico and beyond. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about scary things with Glenn Sparks and David Gilmore, professors. Both Glenn's a professor of communication at Purdue. David's a professor of anthropology at Stony Brook. I'm going to get right back to the phones. We've got Tom on the line. Tom?
Oh, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to tell you about a time I was paralyzed with the fear of some noise behind me. And it was an unfinished addition to a house, and the floor was creaky. How do people deal with that paralyzing fear? There's no flight or no flight, no fear, no fight or flight response.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And Glenn, I want to follow up with you. As I listened to Tom, I had that experience once, and in my case, it turned out to be very adaptive. But what is that physiologically, that paralyzing fear?
Well, I think it's a result of a conclusion that you've come to when you're assessing your environment, that your well-being is just under threat. That is, those sounds, whatever those sounds were, you have a context for interpreting those, and the context is that these are threatening to you. It may have come from a film. You know, Hollywood is very good over the years at actually manufacturing new fears for us. A lot of people are still terrified from taking a shower because of watching Alfred Hitchcock's scene in Psycho.
I haven't showered in 45 years. I'm just,
David mentioned staying out of the ocean for 3 years with Jaws. So the media can really encourage us to interpret our environment in such a way that we conclude that our well-being is threatened. I really think that in extreme cases, a person may really need to seek some professional guidance in being able to cope with that and to reinterpret it. You know, after The Exorcist, we played that scene from The Exorcist. There's an issue in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease that talks about at least a half a dozen people who, after seeing The Exorcist, had to be hospitalized. So that kind of extreme reaction is not very prevalent, but it is not unheard of. And I think sometimes when fear reaches that level of intensity, a person really needs to seek some professional guidance in being able to handle that. And I think fortunately the professionals are well equipped to help people get over that and deal with it.
That's true. We do a great job with fear and anxiety. There's an awful lot known. Mm-hmm. Tom, I do hope that's helpful. David, I want to have a talk with you about something. Now, I looked over an awful lot of your writing. I browsed your book. I explored your webpage in some depth. We spoke to you before the show, and I want to say something to you from the bottom of my heart. You're one weird dude.
So I have been told.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm not the first one. So how did you get obsessed with monsters?
Well, the thing is, the reason I'm weird, I mean, I do admit to that, and I revel in it, is I love monsters. And you find that a lot of people like me also love them. And one of the things we love them is their shape-shifting forms, that they are so awe-inspiring, almost godlike. They're terrifying, and we admire them. And I think some level we identify with our monsters, both us and not us, and we have this conversation with them. It's like talking to yourself. It's therapy. It's self-therapy. It's a creating a screen upon which you project your own inner workings of your mind and your unconscious, and you get to see them and work with them and talk to them and dispute with them and conquer them and fight with them and learn about them. It's a way of learning about yourself. It's things that I've been hearing. One of the questions that no one's asked is, why is being alone in the dark house and hearing noises so frightening? But if you're with another person or another bunch of people, it's not so frightening. Now, this is a question about ourselves alone
and what's inside our innermost being that matters.
Yeah, and you know, Glenn touched on that earlier about doing it in a movie versus being alone with it. Yeah, you're right. I mean, we are social animals. So not only do you embrace your weirdness, but you embrace your monsters.
Yes, I do. It's a mutual embrace.
Yeah. you know, on a serious note, you know, when I'm working with people in my office, and we talk an awful lot about that harsh self-judgment, and, you know, it's really not someone else. It's just, you know, it's a part of the brain, a part of the personality, and we do the same thing with that. You know, we try to listen carefully and listen to that voice and listen to the almost embodiment of that voice and simply change our relationship with it, not try to wipe it out, but change our relationship.
Yeah, so I think you've captured it right there when you use the term embodiment, creation of a living, breathing image that represents a part of ourself.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Chris on the line. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I hope you can hear me.
Yeah, not well.
Okay, I'll speak as loudly as I can. Perhaps not all that insightful, but I just wanted to mention in terms of one aspect of this whole bogeyman phenomena, at least with ghost stories, I have found that most ghost stories are also very sad stories. And one of the things I've always regarded, for example, the Eastern State Penitentiary having been converted to a haunted house sort of thing, I've regarded that myself dubiously because I know that people genuinely suffered there. And I know someone who has visited the abandoned grounds of a mental institution who also commented on having felt watched or having a spooky feeling. And I think, well, you have people... Of course, it makes sense, and I think that, if anything, this might be an opportunity to develop or think about a sense of empathy as well. I mean, these haunted stories, ghosts are almost always, you hardly ever hear of a happy ghost, you know, so, and I'll take comment off the, you know, answer off the air.
All right,
but,
Chris.
I hope you can hear me.
Yeah, we could hear you. It's just not great quality, but we heard it all. And I would disagree about the happy ghost thing. You know, my childhood was with Casper, the friendly ghost. I'd be interested, David, in your take first on what Chris said.
Well, first of all, ghosts can go either way. You know, there's an ambivalence there, which is the ambivalence of death, you know, our relationship to it. Accepting it or not, but in most cultures, the ghost can be a helpful ghost and come back as this ancestor worship. And if you treat them right and you do the proper rituals and sacrifices, they help you in life. But if you cross them up, then they turn evil and they come back to haunt. And that's the kind of ghost we're most fascinated with. That's the one with the potential for evil and harm and terror. So... once again, this is a plastic concept. It's elastic, and we really do with these concepts and emotions and body chemistry, you know, what we want. We have total control over the imagery, the emotion, and the moral structure of our imaginary creation.
I want to hear both of you weigh in on the issue of video games, and Glenn, we'll start with you. Is this more of the same on a different screen, or is this a whole new phenomenon?
Well, it's been studied as more of the same in the media effects literature, but I think there are some important differences. I think the games have really evolved over the past two decades, such that the images in these games have have become more and more realistic. And I think that's a very important ingredient that plays a role in how these things might have an effect on people. So the more realistic the image is, the more involving the game becomes, the greater the potential for its impact. I think the other ingredient is important here is interactivity. So in a video game, you're actually doing something. You're quite active. You're responding in particular ways that affect what you see. And that just increases the overall level of involvement. And so I think that the experience for the gamer can be incredibly involving compared to a television program or movie. Not that those are not involving media. There are reports of healthy males in their 20s who become so involved in a video game that they are oblivious to the fact that they haven't taken any nourishment, and they play the game for 24 hours or 36 hours, and then they end up collapsing. Some people have actually died.
I also wonder, and I'm going to turn to you, David, in the little time we have left. Video games is a time when we are not watching our demons. We are the ones that are violent. Is this different in your mind?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the medium, of course, is different because it's computers, which are new. But if you go back to ancient times and to primitive cultures, everyone sits around and listens to scary stories. It's they're not visual unless they're acted out, but they do register at some level, and there's some probably visual component going on in the mind's eye. And then children are scared, but they learn to control it. And then their participation in that is similar, which is that they have incorporated the scary narrative and the frightening images, and they incorporate it and they deal with it, learn about it, and then they retell these tales. And retelling of tales, that's the function of the folk tale and the fairy tale, is to introduce people both to the stories and the images and the monsters and ogres and dragons, but also to permit us free rein to improvise, to take the material and change it according to our own lights and our own needs.
Well,
so it's been going on a long time. It's just the medium is entirely different now.
Yeah, I want to thank you so much. Unfortunately, we are out of time. It's been a great show. It's been both fun and enlightening.
Thanks for inviting me.
Happy Halloween to you.
Thank you. You too. I've been talking about the lore of scary things and how scary things have a place in our history with Glenn Sparks and David Gilmour. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about coping with the tragedy of suicide or attempted suicide on the family and in the community. Well, you can reach us at voices@whyy.org, and I am at drdangottlieb.com. The engineer has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content. Our intern is Emily Haas. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn's our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Happy Halloween.
Tell me.